This podcast is for personal consumption only and may not be proliferated or reproduced in any way without the explicit permission of its author.
Perfect. So, since the very beginning of the history of Western modern colonialism in the 50th century, continental and overseas territorialities and human communities have been portrayed geometrically according to the coordinates of priorness, insideness, and outsideness, and visualized in terms of colors. In fact, a variety of colors were deployed to express mostly homeland and overseas discovered lands and continental and colonized populations' biodiversity. The color assignation to biological, that is historical, cultural, and biological diversity, was consistent with the particular cultural background, religious tradition, historical legacies, contextual logics, and aims of a given situated colonial power relation. The color line resulting from this assignation has been thus historically drawn and redrawn and connected in many different ways, colors, and nuances. The set of crossing lines composing it has generally separated a dominant group from the dominated, and within the dominant and the dominated group, it has also separated a number of subgroups of different gender, class, culture, and religion. Differently from other contexts, metropolitan and colonial, where the relation between dominant and dominated, colonizing and colonized, presupposes a bipolar power relation, in certain colonial locales, the dominated group has been sharply divided into slightly distanced groups, the prior inhabitants, that is indigenous, and outsiders, as migrants. Assuming, indeed, that there is no casual connection between color taxonomies, their topographical inscriptions, and a particular idea of the state, my question is a peculiar economy of colors at play in such a colonialism? Is there a particular situated appraisal of the politics of colors imagined, formulated and applied in Europe and its transoceanic colonial space? And, assuming that there is one, how does this rearticulation work to underpin both the separation of the new settled nation from what is before and a precise visual boundary that distinguishes the new political entity, the inside, from what is outside? His paper will try to grasp the connection between precise raciologies in settled colonial contexts, a particular practical and theoretical articulation of whiteness and blackness, and certain body politics foundational statements. These statements claim the absolute originality of the settled states as political formation, denial of priorness, its biological community or biocommunity as internally homogeneous and homologous to the settled land or insideness, and its separateness from the surrounding areas and population, or outsideness. Referring to the first and the second statements, this paper will investigate the very specific articulation of the black-centered paradigm in the process of settlers' self-racialization. Referring to the third, it will investigate the very peculiar articulation of the white-centered paradigm in the process of altero-racialization, where the operation of extracting the pure white from a racially undeterminated chaos is meant to keep the new political space white. In this survey, the two paradigms, black-centered and white-centered, are reformulated to express two distinct schemas. The first refers to the binary opposition between two groups, colonizing and colonized, to which are attributed opposed colors, white-red or white-black, according to an interpretative schema that admits no other intermediate color apart from those two and their possible encroachments. The second expresses the geometry of colors that results from the separation of whitest white from less, not enough, not so white groups. Within this schema, the experience of slavery and the assignation of blackness to slaves assumes a very particular place, connecting the black-centered paradigm to an experience of exploitation of the labor force typical of exogenous migrants, rather than to a colonizing-colonized relation. In any case, the two paradigms appear in a given social structure as always co-present and intertwined. My paper corresponds thus to a color matching investigation. It aims at exploring in settler colonialism the working of the two logics operating in racist phenomena, the logic of elimination and the logic of exploitation, and their producing, borrowing, and reproducing particular correspondences between political and social statuses and color taxonomies assigned to settlers, natives, and migrants. The importance and originality of using collective humans, because of course the two categories of logic of elimination and logic of exploitation, but also the hetero and altero referential racialization are borrowed from collective humans and Pierre-André Taguieff, two French sociologists. in this field of study lies in their potentiality in catching and describing certain colonial topicality. Theorized and mostly used in the 70s and 80s European debate on race, they have been applied almost exclusively to the European male incontinental context to distinguish and describe radically different forms of racism, like Nazi antisemitism, historical colonial racism, and contemporary anti-migrant racism. To deploy Guillaumin's logics in a survey on settler colonial topicality means displacing and consequently transforming those same categories, adapting them to the particular situation. In transcontinental settler colonialism, indeed, the correspondence between logics and colors are strikingly different from that active in both contexts of Europe and its overseas colonies for trade. This basically depends on the specific functions of colors in the settler locale. There, the two logics are employed to identify the settler sovereign subject and his holders. Their corresponding taxonomies make blackness in Australia and South Africa and redness in the Americas symbolize the unspoken or unspeakable foundational violence against prior inhabitants, logic of elimination, and whiteness corresponding to the set of meanings describing the sovereign subject and a will-be status for Aceros, brown, yellow, and white subjects. As such, the topicality of the original color matching in settler colonialism has not been taken as an issue by either studies on racism, critical race theory, whiteness studies, or postcolonial theory. In this first attempt, the analysis will be stretched across the late 18th century and early 20th century and focus on Australian settler colonialism, quote, in a broader outlook that embraces the US and in South Africa. The choice of these three case studies depends, as we will see, on the close relationship between them in the matter of common racial theories and similar policies of elimination and displacement of natives and restrictions in immigration. In general, colors associated to human phenotypes enter the space of the definition of political statuses as the traditional purport of the visualization of distinction between human and divine, human and animal, and within the category of the human, between purity and impurity, morality and immorality, and all of all dichotomies that lie on the domain of distinction between the various embodiments of good and evil. Since the distinction between human political and unhuman not political took place in classic philosophy, and its translation in terms of the opposition between Christian ecumeny and unfaithfulness in Christian Middle Age, a particular color has been associated to the two sets of categories, privileging fair color for the first and dark color for the second, especially red, brown, and black. The association of a precise color other than white to a particular political, religious, and cultural status has always been inherent to the political community's self-representation within a given space-time dimension. And this has been regardless of whether it was in terms of auto-referential or altero-referential racialization, and whether the color found a rough correspondence to phenotypical characteristics or didn't correspond to any general physical appearance or skin pigmentation. So basically, what I'm doing is borrowing the Collègue Guillaumin's idea of colors as a social construction, so it's a symbolic object, it's not a reality, never. In the arch of time considered in my survey, the geometry of assignments of a precise color and race to given embodied subjects corresponds to a precise shift in both geographical landscapes due to the expansion eastwards and the creation of the so-called Second British Empire and conception of humankind. After the 1850s, the range of colors associated to the other in a variety of contexts fits in that set of taxonomies that correspond to the Darwinian scale that defines improbability in terms of genetic evolutionism. According to this classification, few individuals among Chinese and Indians, much less elements amongst the blacks, and no one amongst the so-called blackest blacks, could rise and gain an evolutional stage that could parallel the biological capacities or potentialities associated to whiteness. In racial evolutionism, native South Africans and Aboriginal Australians were cast outside the human evolution scale and as such considered doubtfully human. According to racial evolutionism, the color black defines this condition. The shift between redness in the pre-evolutionary times of the first British Empire and blackness in defining the outcast of humanity in this particular context is a complicated and multi-layered process resulting from the combination of transnational racialized knowledges and transnational models of racial policies, as testified by the triangular flows of racialized technical and political knowledges between the US, South Africa, and Australia. Because of the impossibility here of a detailed survey on the transformation of the meaning attached to the red color, I'll focus just on the changes occurred in the definition of the black. Black color has been generally associated to indispensable inferiority, especially since African slavery. Earlier, blackness and darkness, the color of the evil, were associated to barbarism and faithlessness in order to demonize a religious, political, military, or economic competitor, or visually identify lower classes. Darker complexion due to sun exposure as a mark of social inferiority. After African slave trade began, the color black corresponded to what is commodifiable, and its indispensability derived precisely from its commodification as enslaved labor force. This economical indispensability reflected also a social and political indispensability as embodying as such the polarity in the color's taxonomy that was needed to define whiteness in terms of cultural identity, political status, labor condition, and social rights. In fact, although black people were asked for labor, they were denied in any form of social and political that is human, according to Franz Fanon, recognition, giving space to a bipolar definition, black-white, of social, political, and legal statuses that assigned to the other pole the possibility of a full citizenship. In Australia's at the colonies, instead, the color black signified an obstacle to eliminate. There was no evil agency or agency at all in killing black creatures because it would help them in reducing their own suffering. In this case, the suspension of the Hegelian circularity of recognition that happens in colonial power relations, as defined by Franz Fanon, or the actuality of the veil described by William Du Bois, the obstructed subjectivity of the black, are pushed to their own extreme consequences. In failing the condition of exploitation of black labor, the status of the servant doesn't come to be, and the result is a statement of unhumanness without appeal. Moreover, black symbolizes the unspeakable and almost extinguished priorness, that is, a disembodied status that has nothing to do with real human beings, but with a sort of metaphysical guilt for the abuse committed in occupying a land that wasn't empty. In Australia, the US, and South Africa, the color brown and yellow signify outsideness and refer to those areas where settler colonialism is not possible and the settler state's frontier can't be further extended. No empty space could be created there. The Middle East, China, Southeast Asia, Mexico, and Mozambique are areas neatly separated from the white settler state by a color line that establishes the homologous relationship between the settled biocommunity and homeland and distinguishes it from the surrounding biodiversity. The brown-yellow biodiversity, that is, outsideness, is indispensable for two reasons. It reminds settler state of its biological and political uniqueness and establishes for itself a status of inferiority. Biodiversity, as opposed to homology, means instead a racialized diversity that through the ocean middle passages and cross area of economic relations provides a permanent supply of a diverse, cheaper, and segregated labor force. This diverse labor force, similar to black slaves, is indispensable precisely because it guarantees the homologous a higher standard of life. The difference between the African slavery and the regime of migration flows, other than about the forms of recruitment and the degree of subjectivity, is in the topographical allocation of colors. In the case of African slavery in both settler colonial Americas, black has been signifying the internal outsideness, assimilated later in the new idea of Brazil or spatially segregated in Jim Crow's America. In the case of volunteer or semi-volunteer migration, in the US, South Africa, and Australia, external outsideness has become of different colors because of a certain reason that I'll be happy to discuss later, but if the case, but not now because it's too long. Takes too long. The double feature of outsideness as indispensable through the threat and the state's effort in reducing the risk of not white migration's deadly violation of its homology may be exemplified at best by the case of Pacific Island indentured laborers in Australia. Pacific Islanders between 1850s and the beginning of the 20th century kidnapped and forced into a semi-slave condition, the phenomenon known as blackbirding, were carefully introduced into the country in sugar plantations in Fiji and Queensland, and then forcefully sent back to the Pacific Islands after the Pacific Islands Labourer Act in order to avoid, as publicly expressed by governors and officials, an Australian replication of the American mistake. That is a multiracial democracy. This color-based model of a temporary and numerically limited recruitment was common to the US and South Africa, as evidenced by US repatriation, so-called repatriation of freed slaves to Liberia and generally Northwest Africa, and Central American indentured migrants to their countries, and South African regime of temporary Mozambican, Chinese, Indian indentured labor. In particular, in the relation between settlers and migrants' labor force, it is the tension between capital and race, or between an indispensable labor force and racial biopolitics, that redraws geometers of inclusion and exclusion from the political community. This tension produced an oscillation between a number of racist immigration restriction policies aiming to impede specific ethnic flows and a more liberal attitude towards immigration expressed in the removal of previous restrictions that is still infected with racism. In fact, even if the latter recognizes the priority of labor supply, it continues to want it cheap and segregated, and it compels migrants into a naturalization or neutralization that erases their exogenous legacy through, for instance, a compulsory substitution of people's exotic surname with an English-like one, like in the case of Chinese in Australia or Japanese in the US. The tension between outsideness and homology, and its result in endless redrawing of citizenship's boundaries, needs a reinforcement of bio-community's racial identity in terms of whiteness. Whiteness in this case appears as an attribute assigned to a collective of individuals, a more or less restricted set of persons whose identity, described through a process of reverse projection when confronted with priorness, is obtained through a process of subtraction when confronted with outsideness. In 19th century settler colonialism, the process of reverse projection could be synthesized basically in the statement that everything is not native, black or red, is white, according to a paradigm that focuses on the distinction between humanness and unhumanness. This is applied also to black slavery, where the association between blackness and unhumanness helped to legitimate the objectivation and commodification of black human beings. The process of subtraction refers to that process that extracts whiteness, subtracting everything considered brown, yellow, not white, and their encroachments with the white, like Mediterraneans, from the non-native, being in red or black. This geometry resulting from the opposition of insideness and outsideness, or between homology and biodiversity, creates an intersection of proximities that, on one end, aggregates the non-blacks, and then disaggregates the non-black spectrum in the biologically homologous, the member of the bio-community. The homologable label as not so white, like Northern Italians, as well as Queenslanders, or Queensland white, so-called poor whites, and Melbourne's prostitutes. And the potentially the same, potentially includable into the political community through a cultural and social homologation. The second, the homologable, is labeled as not enough white or will be white by virtue of his hair supposed darker but still compatible skin color, or his hair low class and gender belonging. The third is labeled brown or yellow, and his hair visual mark of outsideness exceeds his hair potentially includable proximity. As we have seen, this third condition can be fixed in political terms through his hair assimilation into a sort of Habermasian legal citizenship. In this process, the first class of color, white-white, is obtained through a schema white-centric paradigm that extracts the purest, highest expression of whiteness from a set of mid-colors and corresponding status and defines it mainly as male, heterosexual, Christian, middle-class, proprietor, and well-educated. In conclusion, in settler society, what one can find is the cooperation of the two dynamics of reverse projection, that is, black or red-centered paradigm, and subtraction, the white-centered paradigm. Denial of natives' human status, auto-referential racialization, and inferiorization of potentially the same, alter-referential racialization, are collaborating as elements equally foundational to the settler body politic. Operating at the same time, they help to establish an idea of sovereignty that was based at once on exclusive humanness, race unity, and white supremacy. In that sense, I disagree with Pereira in her last book. The new settler state, or new utopia, can be built without creating an empty space, selecting the elect component of its civil society and finding a permanent supply of an exploitable labor force. The difference between the two macro groups defined as native, whether black or red, and not white outsiders or black slaves, resides in their possibility and degree of inclusion absorption into the bio-community as well as the body politic. To the native, a self-representation as outsider that reduces his hair condition to that of the migrant is needed to be able to be differentially included in a society that professes itself as multiracial or multicultural. As such, in fact, without denying its political status, the prior inhabitant cannot be included unless challenging the same foundation of the settler body politic. And thanks. So, I'll present the next speaker.